have two answers to that. One is, we're working hard on the objective tests, but they're not yet ready for prime time. They haven't made it from research into the clinic, and a lot of us are not sure which will be the best of this group of tests. One is looking at the size of different parts of the brain on brain scans, particularly MRI scans. One is looking at how the brain utilizes fuel, utilizes glucose on a PET scan. And there's a very new type of imaging called PIB, which images amyloid itself. Amyloid is thought to be the toxic chemical in Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of investigators who think if we could take pictures of it and find it early, we'll know who gets the disease. So there is a test being worked on in research. It's only in research, and it remains to be seen how good a predictive test it is. The second thing is the soft science is surprisingly good. Our clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease concurs with what you find on autopsy about 80% of the time. Some people say 90% of the time. It's as good as our diagnosis of any other disease.
So, of course, one question that people always have about undergoing this type of screening is, so what if I know? What is the so what if I know? What's the benefit of finding out?
It hasn't been proven yet definitively what lifestyle changes are going to keep your memory good. We have some indirect evidence for that. I think one of the things people can do is use it as an alert to making these lifestyle changes. Interestingly enough, exercise has the best evidence. And there's study after study showing the people who don't get demented are more likely to have exercised. And the amount of exercise is pretty easy. It seems to be on the order of walking half an hour a day, although we're not absolutely sure. Being Americans, everybody wants to know what's the minimum exercise they can do. The problem with such studies is you can never prove that exercise did anything. It's possible that the people who were going to get demented didn't exercise because their brains were changing and because maybe they didn't feel like it or maybe they weren't up to it. Still, I think the indirect evidence is enough to add to all the other reasons that one should exercise. It's been harder to pin down the role of mental stimulation. We all think the brain's like a muscle. If you exercise it, it's going to get stronger. And it kind of makes sense. It's been harder to prove exactly what to do. There's a general sense that activities that involve language may be protective against dementia. Crossword puzzles, reading, everybody's doing Sudoku these days. And it's possible that that kind of mental exercise, which involves actually keeping many different things in memory at the same time to work with, might be helpful. But there's a lot of other evidence along this lifestyle approach, not just a particular leisure activity, but there's evidence that having a diversity, having a variety of leisure activities is protective. One study, like I said, suggested crossword puzzles. Another one suggested dancing. Well, dancing's very interesting because it's a complicated psychomotor activity. Who knows, it might be fun. Another study that we've done at Hopkins suggested that volunteer work might be helpful. There's a study going on now called Experience Corps. And in the first version of this study, they had seniors get trained in how to tutor inner city elementary school kids at risk. And so the seniors were tutoring kids basically that would have been their grandkids' age. And they studied the kids and they studied the seniors. The kids, fortunately, they did better with the tutoring, but the seniors' cognition improved. It's not likely they improved because we trained them to improve. They got a week's worth of fairly easy training. No, they seemed to have improved because of what they were doing. They were working with kids. They were working with language. They were solving problems. So when people ask me, what should I do to preserve my memory? I say exercise, read, try a diversity of leisure activities, and maybe you should try some volunteer work.
So making the diagnosis is good, because if someone finds out that they have a potential problem, there are some things they can do.
There are other reasons to make the diagnosis. Many people come to my office and they know they have, their loved one has dementia. I mean, the person has memory problems and functional deficits. And I find making the diagnosis is more reassuring than not, because first of all, they can give it a name. But second of all, once it has a name, they can learn something about it, and they can put what I call some limits on their anxiety. I find the biggest misconception with dementia is that people are going to fall off a cliff tomorrow, that it's all fallen apart immediately, and that everything has to change today. On the contrary, as I said about the glacier, I can't stop it, but it's probably going to move slowly. And any perception you have that it's moving quickly is probably a misperception. And so you have time to plan. You have time to start treatments. Another reason to make the diagnosis is there are proven treatments for dementia, particularly Alzheimer's disease. They are modestly to moderately effective, but they're extremely safe, and they're well worth a try. And one of the things we found about these treatments is they work at all stages of the disease. They don't work super effectively at any stage of the disease, but they're well worth trying at any stage of the disease.